Hey everybody, it's Becky Davidson, and I want to welcome you to the Rising Above Ministries podcast. You know, Father's Day is coming up this weekend, and we at Rising Above wanted to take some time to honor and to recognize all of the amazing special needs dads out there who are loving and serving and leading their families so well. And in this podcast, you are going to get to meet three dads who are doing just that. Three dads who are loving their families, leading them and serving them so well. And I cannot wait for you to get to hear their insights, to hear their stories, and to hear their heart and the love that they have for their families. So this episode is going to be just filled with wisdom and lots of great information for dads, especially young dads who are just starting out on this journey. And be sure to listen all the way to the end, because at the very end, they're each one going to share the one thing that they wish that they had known early on when their child was first diagnosed that would have helped them on this journey. And so be sure to listen to that, because it is just a wealth of knowledge and wisdom that they have to share with the other special needs dads out there. And I'm so grateful for them for giving up their time to be part of this podcast. Now, I also want to let you know about something that we have available for free on the Rising Above Ministries website. It is a downloadable Bible study called Extraordinary Legacy. And it is taken from some of my late husband's blogs that he wrote, and the blogs that were written for dads of children with special needs. And so right now it's available for free on the Rising Above Ministries website, risingaboveministries.org. So if you've not already downloaded that free resource, take an opportunity to do that, because I know it will be a blessing to you as you raise your amazing children with special needs. So again, I just want to thank Lee Peoples, Wally Bryan, and David Adams for taking the time to join us this week for the Rising Above Ministries podcast. Trust me, you are going to be so glad that you're joining in today, and you will learn so much from the wisdom that these dads have to share with you. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today for the Rising Above Ministries podcast. I am so grateful that you're here and that you're going to share your hearts as dads of children with special needs. And so I want to just take a minute to introduce yourself. Some of you I've known for a long time. Lee, we've just met today. I've known you, but not like never. We've never had a conversation because you were gracious enough to endorse our book, Common Man, Extraordinary Call. And so just to start with you, Lee, tell us a little bit about yourself and your family. A lot of our listeners are going to know who your wife is. Like a lot of us are like, oh, I'm John Alex's mom. Yes, you are Sandra's husband. We'll let you get into that. So tell us about your family.
Yeah, in the special needs community, I'm Sandra's husband. I'm Lee, and we live in Alvin, Texas, which is just south of Houston, and we've been here about 5 years now, and I pastor a church here in Alvin, and we have two boys, a 14-year-old, and then James, who is 12, who has level 3 autism, and he was diagnosed at the age 3, so I think we'll probably get into more of those things later. But we are advocates in the special needs community, big time. One of our passions and my passions is to see more and more churches have special needs ministry. So one thing I do is try to, give the rah-rah speech to the pastors. And then I say, and Sandra can help you figure out all the nuts and bolts of that, and I'll just move on to the next guy. So I'm the mouth. She is the brains in a lot of things. And then, you know, she also does a lot of things for ministry for families. So her podcast, Self Care and Soul Care for the Caregiver, and she's written a couple of books as well. That we're just blessed to be in this community and love to see, how we can help people.
Well, I love that. And I love that you can give the perspective from a pastor and from a dad. I think that's so helpful when you're talking with churches. So thanks for being here. And then Wally is a veteran of the Rising Above Ministries podcast. You were on episode 6 of season 2 with your wife, Lisa, where you guys shared your story a little bit. So tell everybody today, though, a little bit about you as a dad.
So, as you said, Lisa is my wife, and we have two kids. Two adults now, our daughter Kelly, who is grown and married and out of the house, and as I like to say, Gordon's problem now, and we have Matthew, who is 21, and he has Fragile X syndrome, which if you haven't heard of, which most people haven't, it's a genetic condition that the easiest way to say is it's one of the leading known causes of autism. So From a symptoms perspective, by all rights, Matthew is on the autism spectrum. In our case, we just know why, and unlike so many people who don't know why. And we can talk about that a little bit. That comes with a double-edged sword. It's good to know, but comes with some challenges as well by knowing. But that's kind of who we are. With Matthew being 21, he was... We knew he had issues starting around two to three. He was diagnosed at 4. And so we're 17, 18 years down this road. So a lot different place than I was 17, 18 years ago, for sure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be sitting here 17 or 15 years ago. I can say that.
You've learned a lot and come a long way in that time. So that's great. And that's what I'm excited for you to be able to share today. Some of the things you've learned on your journey. Now, David, you and I have known each other about 15 years.
Yeah, something like that.
And you were John Alex's doctor years ago. That's how we met. And then you've moved, and you weren't his doctor, but we still have stayed in touch over all these years. So share a little bit about yourself and your family.
Well, I'm physician living in Auburn, Alabama. I have 3 sons, a 23-year-old that we're trying to help him figure out where he wants to be in life, a 19-year-old who is in college, and then I have a 21-year-old son. He was diagnosed with autism, I guess, when he was 2.5 years ago, and he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes about 5 or 6 years ago. Now, so I guess when we first met, Zeke was about 6 and John Alex was about 7. The same age.
Yeah, they're close to the same age. Yeah. So you've helped us on our journey of trying to deal with autism and diets and supplements and all that that goes along with that over all these years. So, well, guys, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, I was thinking about back when we as parents first start discovering about our child's special needs or disability. And, you know, for so many moms, like I threw myself into research. I started, you know, getting on the internet, which was really non-existent when my son was diagnosed, but, you know, started trying to research and threw myself into trying to help him get better. But a lot of times dads respond differently. So what was your response when you found out? And how did you kind of process through that? So Lee, you want to start?
Yeah, we processed through it very differently. James was typically progressing until the age of 2, so he was hitting all those milestones. But between 2 and 3 is where we started noticing regression. So we actually had an occupational therapist at the church we were serving in Pennsylvania come to us and you know, I'll suggest, hey, you need to see your pediatrician, go look at getting a diagnosis. I can't diagnose, but I think this is what it, you know, is. And so when we began researching autism and saw the kind of checkpoints, we're like, oh, all right, that's what all of this, you know, all these signs are and things. So the diagnosis itself wasn't a shock to us. We actually came in the diagnosis going, all right, we think it's this and we agree with that. Sandra went immediately into, okay, diets and routines and, you know, all that research, kind of like you said, Becky, just went in. And I was like, hey, you know, I need to catch up. I need to process this. And I remember she told me, she said, look, here's a book for you to read. Read it, and I'm going to do all this stuff, and you have to catch up at some point. And so they had come to visit her folks here out in Houston, and literally I read that book on the plane from Pennsylvania to Houston. And when I got off, I looked at her, I was like, okay, I'm ready. Let's go do whatever we got to do. You know? And so it wasn't, you know, just kind of a shock to us, but we were processing at very different speeds, and I had to catch up for sure.
Yeah. So Wally, what about you?
So let's see if I can remember that far back.
Yeah, we've got some years on us since then. Yeah.
So at a similar kind of thing, between 2 and 3, we started noticing development was slowing down, regressing, whatever words you kind of want to put that. Lisa especially, as mom said, something's not right. And of course, at the beginning, and then we went through the challenges of, it's a boy. They do things because we have an older daughter. They do things slower, but, you know, all of those kind of things. But eventually we convinced, that's probably the wrong way to put it. But we finally got to the point that pediatrician said, yeah, we probably need to look into them. We went and we made an appointment with a developmental pediatrician. And kind of part of the interesting part of this to everybody needs to keep in mind, our first diagnosis was extreme ADHD. And at 3 years old, the developmental pediatrician was ready to put Matthew on Ritalin. And she even said, well, we don't really have dosages for a three-year-old, so we're going to have to try and learn. And we kind of walked out a little, shell-shocked with that. And Lisa was like, I don't feel right about that. And so that's kind of one thing I want to say is, I told her immediately, I said, well, your mom, I don't care what a doctor tells me, no offense. I don't care what a doctor tells me. A mom matters as well. And he's lived 3 years without Ritalin. If we go another few weeks, it's not going to have a huge impact. Let's wait and make sure that we're doing what we want to do. And so we felt really strongly about that, got another appointment, got a second opinion from another developmental pediatrician, and that's who actually ended up ordering the Fragile X test for us. She, I still can remember her looking at me and saying, I know a lot of things it's not, but I'm not sure what it is. But there is this one thing that I'm thinking that kind of could fit, and you can run a test for it. It's a simple test. You just have to, it's a, genetics test from a blood test, and you just have to draw the blood and then order the test. So, so we did that, and that's when we came back with the positive test. And so then that was kind of a shock. It's the same kind of thing. It's, Fragile X, fragile what? It's like, what is that?
Right.
And what, we knew what we saw day to day, but so thankfully, Fragile X has a national foundation, and we reached out to them, and they were very helpful and supportive and had a lot of information. The doctor that found the gene, the defect in the gene, was actually an Emory doctor from here in Atlanta, so that gave us, at least at that time, there was some good local resources. So we had those things. But it was a shock. And, going from there, progressing on, we finally found a preschool, that a special needs preschool. And first day Lisa dropped him off, she dropped him off and sat in the car in the parking lot and cried for an hour.
Of course she did. Yeah.
That was kind of the thing.
Right.
And I'm the IT guy, so I compartmentalized everything and focused on different things, and I process those emotions very differently. But that's kind of where, where we started and how we got there. The kind of thing I wanted to point out that's, how we dealt with it a little bit different is, and we mentioned this before when she and I were on together, because it's a genetic condition, and without going through all the genetics, it is her. Because it's my son and it's on the X chromosome, and just so that means it has to be her. we had to deal with her guilt. And I never projected that on her. She projected it all on herself. And to me, it was completely illogical, because you didn't do anything to this. You didn't do this to him. It was any more than it was done to you, you know, to begin with, kind of thing. But what I had to kind of learn is, okay, it is illogical. That is correct. But it's, that doesn't make it non-emotional.
Right.
And we have to deal with the emotions, and we've been dealing with them for, you know, 18 years.
All these years, yeah. Yeah.
Well, to some degree, it's better. I think she's come around with that. But a lot of these things go and come. It's not a straight line progression.
Exactly. Well, now, David, you being a physician, how was that for you? And what did that look like in your family to discover about Zeke?
I don't know if it's any easier, because it's never easy. You know, have a better ability to access resources quickly. But even then, I mean, when Zeke was diagnosed, it was kind of early in the autism epidemic, and there really weren't a lot of resources, mm-hmm. especially in our area of Tennessee. I mean, you had that same experience.
Yeah.
And you still have to, you know, you still have to emotionally process it. You still have to emotionally process it as a family. And there tends to be, between family members, wife, husband, wildly different ways of processing, wildly different timelines, which creates kind of emotional gaps in a lot of cases and a lot of people. For me, a lot of times, the ability to access and kind of understand the information, especially at the beginning, was very difficult, because you read it and you look at it and you find the information and it becomes so overwhelming. And you're running it forward 20 years, 30 years in advance.
Yep.
So, and at the same time, you have to cope with, you know, Zeke regressed somewhere between around 20 months, diagnosed at 2 years. We still had to cope with a kid that was incredibly hyperactive, not potty trained, and staying up all night.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any way that it's easy for anyone.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't matter how it comes. It's a shock, and you have to process, and everybody's going to process it through it at different speeds in different ways. And so, you know, one of the things that I know, especially dads deal with, and it's the loss of those dreams. You know, I know when our son was born, Jeff dreamed of taking our son to his beloved University of Tennessee football games and playing sports with him and doing all those kinds of things. And then when he started to realize, you know, that's not going to be our reality, that was really tough for him. So what was something that you had to deal with that you had dreams that you had to let go? And how did you do that?
I think for me, it's kind of some of those, it's just all those typical things you think of with your kids. You know, I'm going to take them fishing and ride bikes and play sports. And we laugh because I was a high school basketball coach for 10 years before I came into the ministry. And Sandra loves sports. Our first date was to a NC State, Florida State football game. And, I mean, you know, so I was in love right off the bat because she knew what pass interference yeah. was. And, I mean, you know, yeah. she knew all those things.
He's
right.
The one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so that's ESPN is on in our home all the time. And but our 14-year-old son, David, our typical son, has nothing to do with sports, like nothing. He loves drama and theater and acting. And, you know, and so we kind of laugh like, okay, we have two very sport-oriented people, and we have two boys who nothing with sports.
Oh, okay.
So it's just really a kind of a joke in our home now. But, I mean, yeah, I think it is. It's processing some of those things of, yeah, okay, he's never going to be married. He'll always be with us. Never going to drive a car, go to college, you know, hold down a steady job and things unless something radically changes. Mm-hmm. And so you process that early on, you process that as they get older, and you keep processing that. And so I think for us, it's still, for me at times, it sneaks up on me of even when James is around typical other 12-year-olds, and I see how far advanced they are versus him in a lot of ways, you know. And so those milestones, I still think you know, they just sneak up and I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, 13 or 12, he should be able to do this. And now it's, he can't do this, this, and this. And so that's, I don't know if that goes away. I know these guys are a little farther down the road than I am, but you know, I still notice that within me, that still that's a struggle.
Yeah. I mean, I think we grieve throughout the whole process. There's different things that pop up. Mm-hmm. And we grieve those things. What about you, you other gentlemen? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm kind of the opposite. Lisa's the one in our household that dealt with all the milestone depression, I mean, challenges, whatever words you want to put on that. She's the one that when milestones came and they were missed, because they all were, mm-hmm. that really hit her hard. And I had to work hard to support her with that. And I, part of the challenge with that is because it didn't hit me hard the same way, I process it a little differently. She'd get mad at me for not getting mad. And so we had to support each other, and I had to learn how to support her and realize that just because it didn't affect me, it was still affecting her.
Yeah.
For me, it just came a different way, not right or wrong, but just different. I'm kind of, for better or for worse, and I think it's some of both sometimes, I'm very much kind of taking things as they come. Okay, that's not it. Here's my new path. Okay, what's this path look like? And then that's just what it is.
Yeah.
It is a blessing at times. Sometimes it can lead you not to fight for some things maybe you need to fight for, so you have to be careful. But identifying and understanding how you feel about it. For me, what really came when you talk about the challenge you face, Becky, is rather than it being a milestone, it's when I would go to do something with Matthew, whatever it was, and I would see that he couldn't do something that he wanted to do. And a simple story to kind of illustrate that was when he was little, probably, I don't even know what old, probably 5 or 6 years old, we used to go to Myrtle Beach at that time, to the beach every year. And he loved baseball, which my wife is a sports nut too. So, you know, we would all sit around. I mean, it was awesome because when, you know, we'd put the Braves on every summer and Matthew would sit in front of the TV and just be fixed on the TV and love watching baseball, especially earlier like that. So in Myrtle Beach, we decided to go to the Myrtle Beach Pelicans game. Seemed like a cool thing for us all to do. And we get there and we knew it'd be a little different with him, with his anxiety and stuff, but I have him in a stroller and I kind of stroll him up to the right field line out kind of to a picnic area. And we're kind of watching. He's very intrigued, very intense into watching the game live that he's seen on TV. Then all of a sudden something happens, the crowd yells, and the guy gets on the PA system and makes some big announcement, and we were done.
Yeah,
it was done, and I couldn't get him to calm back down. I mean, and now I can look back and I realize, I mean, all the things I see, and if I could have to know then what I know now. But ultimately, and we came in two cars, knowing that, I mean, that's one thing, that's something we do.
We
all
learn
the time.
To do. We learn to adapt, don't we? Yeah.
And so he and I went to, you know, left. And as I'm pushing in the stroller back, and as soon as we get out of stadium to the car, he calms down. And then, you know, depending on how bad it is, how long it takes to recover. But he recovered and then he was fine. But, you know, I had my little cry walking to the car that night, not because of a milestone, but because here's this thing making my son not be able to experience something that he would love.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the same as a milestone in a way. It's just, but that's how it hit me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that's definitely something that you end up having to work through is, in a lot of ways, being a parent of a special needs child, there is a long grief that's in the background. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's way down in the background, and sometimes it comes up to the forefront, but there is a long grief in terms of what you're missing. And for me, it's a lot of times is, you know, the day-to-day communications. I want to have a conversation with him.
Yeah.
I want to know what he did at school today. And so for a lot of that, it is a background of grief. You know, things like marriage or driving a car are so far off and seemingly, you know, just out of the realm of consideration, but it's the everyday sort of things. And you know, you often have nights at the pillow, you put your head on your pillow and you go, I don't like it this way.
Yeah. Yeah. Many nights like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I get that. Just wanting to have a conversation and to know. Yeah. I know Matthew has language, I think. Isn't that right, Wally? Matthew's got some language.
Oh, yeah. We fired our speech therapist.
But I think James is nonverbal.
James is fairly nonverbal. A lot of his speech is repetitive, so it's lines of TV shows, movies. He can tell us what he wants, like goldfish, Cheez-It mix, and things. Mm-hmm. And so I think to David's point, you know, it is, he doesn't have that ability to answer the cognitive questions like, how are you feeling? Or what'd you have for lunch today? What was fun about the field trip you just took at school? You know, and none of that is... He always answers what if you give him two choices, he always picks the second choice. And it's hilarious. So one of our jokes right now is we'll say, James, are you happy or grumpy? And I mean, he can be happy, but if you ask him, you're happy or grumpy, he'll go grumpy, you know, grumpy, you know, and he's laughing, you know, but and I think to Dave's point, there's those points of grief where sometimes it's like, man, this stinks that he can't do this or he can't do that or answer those simple questions. But one of the blessings we found is he loves attention because he's also an attention seeker. And so he's not a sensory avoider, he's a sensory seeker. And so he's learned that if he will mix up a line that he repeats from Thomas the Train over and over, we'll go, oh, James, that's so funny, and we'll laugh, and he'll laugh, and then he'll continue to mess up the line on purpose because he knows he's getting a reaction out of it. And so we've come to really enjoy that because that is a way he is communicating with us and he is interacting in his own way. And so we've learned to kind of also mess up lines and then he laughs and, you know, and so that's our talking, if you will.
Ours is, you know, Matthew's very verbal, but some of what you said is kind of the same thing is he's very verbal, but he's still very rote and very methodical, logical, that very autism-ish way of talking. If you get into anything abstract, it's just outside of you know, just don't really know what to say. And Matthew's default answer is no, so it's not the second choice. It's if you ask a yes or no question, it's no. So we've learned how to word the questions. kind of do the same thing. But he will, you know, a lot of what we get is he's telling us things that he's seen or, you know, seen on TV or whatever. And it may be he's all into the weather and he's all into sports. So I've known sports scores for the last 15 years of every sport, every team. It doesn't matter who. I know who played who and who won and what the score was and that kind of thing. So it is very rote in that way, but he hears us talking about sports and that's all he knows how to do. But as far as verbal, it's very verbal, especially the more amped up he gets, it gets going faster and faster.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we get the diagnoses, you know, there's some dads that we've seen that they, you know, like you guys, you jump right in, you know, Lee, you read a book on an airplane, you're ready to go. You know, there's some dads who are like, okay, this is what we got to do. We're going to do it. But then there's other dads who don't do that, who just cannot grasp with the reality of their new normal. So what do you think makes the difference between those dads who choose to just accept their role and say, this is, we're going to do this and we're going to work together and we're going to make this happen, and then the dads who often decide to be vacant dads or absent dads and not be there to support the family, to not be there to be a part of encouraging their family on this journey? What do you think makes the difference between the dads who can who jump in there and do it and the ones who choose not to?
I think David should go first.
I'm going to flip the script on you, Becky.
Okay.
Because in my experience, obviously the only dads I see are the dads who are there.
That is true.
But I've seen enormous numbers of men who have stepped up to the plate and are honestly my heroes, who are dealing with children that are far more complex than mine, with less resources than I have available, but are in there, they're fighting, they're holding on, they're holding their families together and going on. So you almost have to kind of look at the positive. What are the people who seem to be succeeding doing right? And at the same, you know, I think the first thing is finding something to do. To sit there and have something nebulous that you don't have. If you're stuck on the why question and can't ever move on to the what next.
Absolutely, yeah.
Then you're stuck in this place that's emotionally untenable. And then secondly is, I think we as a culture do a terrible job preparing people for the real world, i.e. a world that's very imperfect, that bad things happen, that there are struggles to overcome, that it isn't there to meet our, you know, the world's not there to meet our needs. And so, you know, it's in a lot of people when they're, for lack of a better term, when autism punches them in the nose, disappear. And emotionally can't, you know, brush the dust off, get up, and go on to the next thing. And so I think that happens. But the people I see that have succeeded have managed to stay engaged, managed to move on to what do I need to do next, managed to kind of be able to process the emotion slowly, but not allow that process and the emotions to shut them down.
That's good.
My thought, you know, kind of piggybacking on that, is one of the things I thought about is, I mean, so many of us men are problem solvers. That's what I do at my line of work. I'm a problem solver. It's on computers, but it's diagnosing, it's troubleshooting, it's problem solving. Not altogether that different than a physician who's diagnosing and problem solving. The medium is quite different, of course, but I'm wired to fix things, identify the problem, fix it, and move on to the next problem. And I think that's the way a lot of us as dads are, and it's very hard. You almost reach a point where you don't know what to do next, to your point, so you do nothing. And I would almost caution people, if you don't know what to do next, do something. And then if that doesn't work, adjust. But doing nothing, it's almost like not choosing is a choice. It's the same kind of thing. It's very easy.
Do something even if it's wrong.
Yeah. It's so
if
easy.
Your wife will let you.
I'm going to go over here where I know what to do. And I think it's the familiarity, the comfort that draws a lot of men away from this family setting we're talking about.
Yeah.
And not a whole lot of these guys hit the nail on the head with it. I agree with, you know, both of them is we want to fix things, and we come to the realization really fast as dads, this is something we can't fix. And so we have to figure out in that sense, then best, how do we serve? How do we serve our family? How do we serve our wives? How do we serve our kids in that way? And how can we love them the best way we can love them? And so I agree with David and Wally on that. It's finding what's next to do and just focusing on what the next step is. We call it the new normal in our house. We just constantly adjust to a new normal. And we're like, okay, we're in this normal now. And all right, let's do this, this, and this. And then, you know, that may change in a week. It may change in a month. It may change in 6 months. And then when it changes, okay, now we're in this new normal. And it's just trying to stay in that present moment of seeing what's next that has to be done. And yeah. So.
Real quickly, you may find this kind of funny being in ministry. So my part of that was about 9 months into our diagnosis, I made an appointment with our pastor. Mm-hmm. And I went and sat down with him. And I sat across his desk and said, I mean, it wasn't across the desk, but I mean, whatever. But I sat there with him and said, I basically bared my soul to him and said, I'm at my wit's end. I don't know what to do. I've tried everything I know to try. And I can't fix it, essentially. I'm sure I didn't say it like that, but that's what I was essentially saying. And so I paused and looked at him and waited for the pastor who knew everything to tell me what to do. And it was kind of, I laugh now. It wasn't funny then. And he kind of just looked at me and I'm like, wait a minute, you're supposed to be telling me, you know, and
how to fix it.
That's my joke now. I look back and it's so funny to me. But at the time, but that was still a very watershed moment for me, because what I realized, and it, so to kind of finish that story, the very next day, my wife got a call from actually a staff person at church, to which created an issue, because my wife then said, did Pastor so-and-so tell you to call? Mm. No, was he supposed to? And so we kind of had to settle that. But it was, what was clear to me, it was God was saying, I've got you. What he did was a very small thing, very simple thing, but we received a call the next day with some help. What the help was, I don't even remember what it was now, and it doesn't really matter. But what I firmly believe for me personally, I can speak for me personally, is I had to get to that point where I recognized I was at the end of my rope before God was going to act. Because if he'd acted before, I would have thought I had done something. Mm. And part of this message that was about me at that point and not about my son was I had to realize that it was not about me and there was nothing I could do. And I had to just open up. And then at that point, then God could act, and I knew it was God moving.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, I think so often just for the dads who feel like they, you know, like David, you were saying, just do something, to take a step, do something. And I think a lot of times, I'm going to speak to the moms here, a lot of times we like to be control freaks and want things done a certain way, and maybe – you know, we need to come alongside and help, you know, have those conversations of how we can join together. What are some things, you know, that I know Jeff and I would have had those talks early on. You know, when J.A. was little, I was running the show when it came to his care and his, you know, I was doing the research, doing all this. And then we finally came to the place of going, okay, we need to do this as a team. And that's when things started getting better, when we could do it as a team. So what would you say to the moms out there as some encouragement to help them know how to communicate with you men, you know, as to how to help you know what the next step is and know what to do if you're not sure what to do? I'm sure it's not nagging. I'm sure your answer will not be nag us until we do it, right?
Well, one thing I will say, and if done wrong could be nagging, but what I will say is, and my wife and I've had some good excitable discussions about this topic, is tell us what you want us to do. And at times she would say, but I shouldn't have to. And I go, maybe you shouldn't. That may be true, but you do. And the reality of that and the honesty of that is, look, and I heard it put this way. I didn't come up with this good of a phrase. I'm not that good at this, but it was husbands, most genuine husbands will walk through a wall, will walk through fire for their wives if she asks them to. And that's kind of where I was early on. Part of it was there again, because I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So I needed her to tell me, what can I do to help you? it didn't matter what it was, I could go do it, and it gave me something to go do. Now, do that without nagging, yes, that would, I'm sure nagging is never going to bring the, it never worked with the kids, so I'm pretty sure it doesn't work with us. Yeah.
I don't think it's a spiritual gift.
That's in the, not in your version, huh?
Well, I think to go off what Wally said is one of the things we struggle with as men, the top sin condition all of us have is being passive. I mean, it's, you know, that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Adam said, you know, God said to Adam, hey, don't eat off the tree, essentially protect Eve. Satan comes to Eve, tempts Eve. You know, she's got the fruit in her hand. And Adam's standing there and doesn't say, hey, stop talking to the snake. Like, put the fruit down. You know, I mean, he's just passive. He's there. And I think sometimes we do slip into that being passive because we can't fix this. And we lose hope in saying, all right, well, I can't fix it, so I'm just not going to do anything. Or, you know, that's up to you. You're the mom. You parent. I'm going to go work, things like that. So one thing that has worked well for us over the years, because of the way Sandra and I process things and communicate differently, is she'll often come and say, okay, hey, I've been researching this and, you know, here's a couple of options. Here's some things I've learned. What do you think? You know, and so she kind of empowers me with a lot of that knowledge. And then, or you may want to read this, you may want to look in that, because, you know, like Wally said, we need those, I think, just clear steps sometimes to outline, because one of the things we're going to fight against is just being passive as men. That's the top thing we fight on.
Well, and that kind of leads into something else I wanted to talk about. You know, so one of the things that I see so often is that dads don't know how to spiritually lead their home, don't know how to be the spiritual leaders of their home. In fact, I asked a dad one time in a conversation, I was like, you know, what does it look like, you know, to spiritually lead your family? And he was like, well, I don't, my wife does. And, you know, I just found that so interesting that he just wasn't even sure what that looked like and what to do. And, you know, I know now with me being a widow and that being on me, that's a big role and a big responsibility. So what are some things that you do in your home to ensure that your family is on the right track spiritually? What are some things that you do to encourage them in their walk with the Lord? And, you know, even for our kids who are nonverbal, that doesn't mean that they don't know and understand spiritual things. So what are some things that you all do to spiritually encourage your family and lead them in their relationship with the Lord?
The pastor doesn't want to go first.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was just going to. I preach to him every Sunday.
I'll start. I mean, part of it started back at the beginning. I was kind of like that dad too. I wasn't sure exactly what that meant either. Yeah. Sometimes today, I'm still not totally sure exactly what that means. But one thing, you know, it's kind of like do something, even if it's wrong. You got to be careful about in this topic, maybe. But but to not do anything is definitely wrong. And you don't have to know all of it to do something. That's, I guess, what I would be trying to say is pick something that you can understand and do and start moving forward. And it also means sometimes you have to step aside and invest in your own faith walk before you can invest in your family's faith walk. We as parents, and as you know, moms and dads, moms probably worse than dads, really, but we are so focused on our children, we don't focus on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that, and that's something Lisa and I worked on, and we had to tag team because that's our reality, but made sure that we had time to focus on ourselves. So that we, because investing in the parents, investing in yourself is investing in your child. Yeah. In fact, that's how we came to know of Rising Above Ministries. Lisa, it actually wasn't by the brook. It was before that. It was when you and Jeff came to Atlanta to do some of the day
We have one-day conferences in Atlanta.
One-day conferences. Yeah. That's how Lisa got started, and she went. And then from there, it went to going to buy the book. And that's been a huge thing for her ever since. So it's even little things like that. But we had to begin that faith walk ourselves, too. And, you know, we had started before we had kids, but we weren't in the same place. I mean, and I don't really know how to say it. That's, I guess, the part is it just begin. Begin doing something and then make sure that, and realize, too, that if you have multiple kids, don't neglect the typical one, you know, for the special need ones, needs one. Kelly said this one time, I wish I had Fragile X, and my heart sank because I realized what that meant. And I didn't get mad at her for saying it. I knew exactly what she meant. I just didn't really want to hear it. but we constantly did things for her, we kept taking her to church, even when we couldn't take Matthew to church, things like that. And I don't know. I'll just stop because
I don't know. I think we live in kind of a Western American delusion that somehow leaving a Bible study is somewhat more spiritual than scraping the poop off the walls after the kids smeared it. You know, I think spiritually leading, I think it comes down to using words, but actions. And I think this is what a lot of the men that I see that are just, I see have done, you know, have, you know, crowns in heaven laid up for them. They just step down and lead. You know, they're taking the lead in changing diapers in an 18-year-old, which I have friends who have children who are still in that place. They're taking the lead in terms of okay, I'm going to take the kid and you're going to go to the grocery store for an hour, which is a vacation.
Lisa, you know, might argue that when she wants to get somewhere else for her vacation, but yeah.
But, you know, at least when they're first diagnosed, it is.
Yeah.
Just to
and so stepping, yes, starting with that and recognizing, you know, what both of you had said is your wife's in a different emotional place.
Yeah.
Than where you are, and stepping back and saying, okay, she's in a, Lord knows where she's at, but I've got to somehow find her and sort that out.
Which one thing with that, and Lee, I'll let get to you, but one of the things that came to mind as you mentioned that is a big verse and chapter that has meant a lot to me is Ephesians 5, and I just like to read the first half of Ephesians 5, which is why women don't like Ephesians 5. But if you really read the whole chapter and read the second half of the chapter, there's really more put on the men than on the women in that chapter. And it pivots about halfway through in 5:25 when it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That means, yes, in a physical sense, I have to be willing to die for her, but it also means I have to be willing to die for her every day. And if that means wiping the poop off the walls so she can go do something else, I mean, it's all of those things that is part of that role as a dad and as a husband to support that way.
Well, that's servant leadership. And I think that's a beautiful thing is that if you are, like you said, David, doing those, you know, those tasks that are not fun and nobody wants to do, but that's setting that example of that servant leadership. And I think that's great. Lee, what do you have?
Well,
as the pastor of the group here,
we've talked a lot about poop on the walls.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and
it's
spirituality.
A true thing, you know, it happens.
I'm glad I'm not the only one on that illustration I've had to use. I think, you know, the big thing I encourage our congregation in, when it comes to suffering is to be present, to show up to worship. And I tell them all the time, I say, I know there's so many of you that are battling other issues in your life, whether it's cancer or you've gone through hard times, you lost a spouse, you lost a child. And when you show up to sing, when you show up to read your Bible, when you show up to serve someone else, that's giving a testimony of what you believe in God. And that's, and God's using that to encourage someone else and build faith in somebody else. And so I encourage folks, show up. I mean, you know, be there, be present, be active in that way, because God's going to use that testimony along the way. Another thing we've tried to work on with David in helping him just kind of build a theology of who God is and how to worship God is to give him the freedom to really express sometimes frustrations he might have toward God as being a brother of a son with disability. And, you know, we're like, hey, you know what? God can handle those frustrations. And let's talk about it. And let's voice that. I mean, you know, because at the end of the day, I believe in a God that can heal, you know, right off the bat. He didn't, you know, he didn't have to even hardly think about it, you know, blink of an eye and all this is gone. And so, yeah, that's a God I believe in, but then that's a God who's chosen to leave that disability and sometimes suffering in our lives. And that's hard. That's hard to wrestle with as believers in Christ, is this is this all-powerful God that's yet chosen not to take it away. And so I think as even as men and as ladies and in our marriages, we've got to create that opportunity to have those very frank discussions sometimes. And Sandra and I do, where we go, this stinks, it's hard, you know, why hasn't God done this or this? And, you know, we sometimes we get tired of having to battle this. And, you know, but at the end of the day, that's spiritual growth. And, you know, because you're dealing with those thoughts, it's causing you to critically think. It's causing you really to look at where your hope's in. So that's a little bit where we're trying to work through that.
And it's a process. The whole thing is a process. And, you know, it's one of the things I love about our kids, even our ones who are nonverbal, who, you know, the world would look at them and, you know, question the value of their worth so often. But they are some of the best teachers out there. So what would you say is something that your child with special needs has taught you that you have never learned any other way?
A lot of grace. A lot of grace. And, you know, I've learned to love James just for who he is, not for who he's not, you know. And we have a blast in our home. And there's times folks will talk to us and they're like, why are you guys always so happy about this and that? And, you know, all the things you go through. I'm like, because I just love my kid. I think he's cool. You know, we laugh all the time when he does the Thomas the Train line wrong again for the, you know, 100th time.
Now this time, yeah.
Yeah, you know, now ask me when he wakes up at 4 a.m. and he's ready to go to Target how I feel. But yeah. But we've learned to love him for who he is and not just for who he's not or the things he can't do. But I'm just learning to celebrate him and the way God's created him and made him. And, you know, I tell this to people all the time. He's made me a better man. He's made me a better follower of Jesus. I know this is going to sound super weird to people because it usually does when I get asked this. I don't pray for the healing of my son anymore. You know, if God wants to heal him and take autism away, cool. I'm all right with that. But I don't know if I would really want that at the end of the day, because I've seen the avenues and doors that God has used Sandra and me and him to just work in a way that's incredible. And so we've just learned to celebrate that, you know, and to see that he's brought hope to us, taught us love and grace and how to serve. And he's taught that to so many other people in his nonverbal way.
David, what about you and Zeke?
Oh, go ahead, Wally.
We're going to Wally, okay.
because you say that, Lee, it's funny, because I've come to that same conclusion myself. For years, I prayed for my son's healing, because some people say it's a genetic defect, it can't be fixed. It's like, it can't be fixed by me or by any of us on this call, but the God who created him could change it in a blink of an eye. But what I finally came to is that that's not God's plan. That's not God's will. And I became okay with that, to the same point of view, is that what I kind of came to is Matthew's not defective. He doesn't need to be healed. He doesn't fit in with our society norms. He doesn't process the same things the way society does, and he doesn't behave the way society would want him to, and those kind of things. There's nothing wrong with him, and there's so much that's right, to your point, because things he's taught me about valuing what's real and what's important rather than stuff and things, because more things is just more stress to him. And that's the same thing for all of us if you open your eyes and see it. And he's taught me that. And then just that pure love and joy that he has when he isn't over anxious, it's infectious. And people who have seen him and worked with him, I've had many people tell me that them helping him or working with him, whatever, they're the one that ends up with the bigger blessing than Matthew does.
So true. I see that often. I hear the same thing about John Alex. So very good. David, do you have anything to add?
I'm kind of in a different place. You end up having to learn to live with a tension that we have to live with in this world. On one hand, there are some things profoundly wrong with what autism does. With the opportunities, the ability for him to communicate and fulfill what it means to be the image of God. And yet at the same time, there are things that are profoundly right in terms of teaching us to give up on expectations, teaching us to learn patience, which means I'm impatient, it means you don't have it. Teaching you how to love someone that is reciprocating that love in much different ways than what you expect. And learning to receive that. So it's living with this kind of intense dichotomy. And then some days you're at peace with who he is, and some days you're not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because you see the level of suffering that he goes through. You know, because, you know, Zeke is partially verbal, but sometimes he will say, I want brain surgery, cut out autism.
Mm. Wow.
So, you know, it's there's things that's profoundly not right. But we live in a world with a lot of things that are profoundly not right.
Yeah.
And we live in a, you know, it's a kingdom that's come but not as yet. And so living with that is and being at peace with that and not being at peace with that is a difficult kind of place to walk.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, we're at the closing in on the end of our time here together. And one of the things we always do is we end every podcast with the one thing. So what would be the one thing you would tell a dad? Like if you were sitting across the table with a dad who's just gotten a diagnosis, they're just finding out about their child's special needs, and you are years and years down the journey, what would you tell that young dad or that younger you all those years ago? Something you know now that you wish that you had known then, that you would share that wisdom with a dad who's just starting out on this journey?
I think going a little off of what David just said is, you're going to have some of the best times and you're going to have some of the hardest times. But if you will give your life over to Christ, you're going to find a God who is going to be with you through it all. And you don't have to worry 10, 20, 30 years down the road. Just get through tomorrow. And then when you wake up tomorrow, get through tomorrow and learn that lesson over and over and over again, that there's going to be some really sweet times and some really hard times. But, you know, God's going to be with you through it all. Just get through tomorrow.
Wally?
For me, it just maybe a little more tactically than that. But one is...
You are the IT guy, by the way.
seek to view life and experiences through the eyes of your child. What I mean by that is, the best way I can do it is give an example when, especially when Matthew was younger, but it's the same kind of stuff that happens now, is we took him to the zoo or the aquarium, and Matthew goes to those and experiences them in fast forward. We walked up, we looked at the lions, he looked out at the lion. Okay, I've seen a lion. Let's move on. There's no pause, there's no wait, and the anxiety is also moving him faster and faster. We see the whole zoo in about 30 minutes, and he's ready to go home. And me, looking at it from a value equation, I know what we paid to get in, and it's like, we need to be here all day long. And so what I had to learn was his enjoyment, don't try to force his enjoyment to be my enjoyment.
That's
and
good.
If he enjoyed it, then we got our money's worth. Mm. And it's that's a simple, kind of a simplistic view, and it's hard. I'm still 18 years into it, still trying to understand how he views things. But to try to do that, it helps with some of that tension of the good and the bad, that you can maybe realize. Because the other part is, if you try to force him somewhere he isn't set up to go, everybody's going to be miserable.
Yeah. Good point. David, close us out. What is your one thing?
I could say run, but that would be the wrong thing.
Not exactly what we were going for.
Oh, sorry. The one thing I wish I had at the first diagnosis is finding a male who had been through what I was about ready to go through.
Yes. Yes.
And could sit down and listen. Because what you end up doing is being left with the inability to do what Wally was saying, to see it through different eyes, to realize your whole perspective in the world has to change. Your whole way of living has to change. Your expectations have to change. I wish I could have found someone that could have sat down and kind of prepared me better. Because a lot of the, helpful advice and sympathy that I got from people who hadn't been through that ended up being painful in the end.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's we didn't touch on that in this podcast. We've done a podcast several months ago talking about the importance of community for men and finding that band of brothers who can walk this journey with you. And I think that's so important. You know, for women, that's such an easy thing to do. We all love to talk. We'll get on the phone. I talked to Lisa yesterday, Wally, for about 45 minutes. And, we can get on the phone.
I was by at one point and just kept on walking.
Just kept on walking. But for men, that's more of a challenge to find that person. But to find your battle buddy is what the term we used in Common Man Extraordinary Call, to find that person who can walk with you and having someone who is several years down the path further than where you are. And I think that's such a great thing, and a great thing to challenge the you veteran dads that we're talking to here today, for other dads like you, to seek out those young dads who are just getting those diagnoses and to be able to be there and walk with them through that. So I think that's great. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for giving up your time to have this conversation with us. And I'm so grateful to say that, none of you fall in that category of vacant dads or dads who are not involved and engaged. And I just appreciate you and the way that you lead your families and your children well. So thank you, and happy early Father's Day. This will be our special Father's Day podcast. So happy early Father's Day to all of you all. So thank you so much for being with us on our podcast.
Thank you, Becky.
Thank you.
thank you for listening to the Rising Above Ministries podcast. We would like to thank Jimmy Thorpe and Patrick Mayberry for providing the music for our podcast today. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a rating and review. This helps others like you find our content more easily. You can learn more about how Rising Above Ministries is encouraging the special needs community by checking out our website at risingaboveministries.org or by finding us on Facebook and Instagram. We look forward to connecting with you.